This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program, we speak to Malcolm Green, who talks about the loss of his late father, Harry, who died at the age of 88 to COVID-19. We'll hear about how the loss of his father has impacted on his family and how he feels about the way the crisis has been handled in the UK. Ari Jesner from the Office of the Chief Rabbi would tell us why he is so heavily involved, and personally as well, on the change in law around organ donation and what that means for the Jewish community. Rabbi Laura Jenna Klausner, the senior rabbi to Reform Judaism here in the UK, has announced her departure. We'll speak to Rabbi Jenna Klausner about her plans from October when she steps down. Dov Foreman would tell us about his great-grandmother, Lily Ebert, who has found a note from an American soldier, and now about the journey that they went on to try and find and make contact with the family of the author of said note. And as if all of that isn't enough, we'll also hear from comedian Ashley Blaker, who has some wise words for us surrounding the reopening of restaurants. But before all of that, let us begin this edition of the Jewish News Podcast, as we usually do, with a look through your copy of the Jewish News for this week. Joining me to go through it is editor Richard Ferrer and news editor Justin Cohen. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Phil.
Hello, Phil.
Right, let's start off with a look at the front page. And my, I mean, you've had some striking headlines, but goodness me, this one really sort of makes you think, wow, what is this? Yoni's brother backs organ donor scheme. And at the subheadline, sibling of teen killed in suicide bombing, whose kidney saved a Palestinian girl's life, urges community to sign up. Powerful stuff, Rich.
Yes, most of our listeners will be aware of Yoni Jesner, the Scottish Jewish teenager who in 2002 died in a suicide attack in Tel Aviv on a bus. His brother, Ari Jesner, who's a senior member of the Chief Rabbi's team, has said this week that the new organ donor rule, which is going to be coming out in the next few weeks, the Organ Donation Deemed Consent Act, is something that he would endorse. It's certainly something that his boss, the Chief Rabbi Ephraim Mervis, has endorsed. The little I know about halacha, I know obviously it's according to Jewish law, you're meant to be buried as you were born, but the altruistic act of giving your organs to somebody else after you have passed would be the religious, humane thing to do. So it's a matter of great conjecture and confusion, you have to say, in the Jewish community. But the new organ donation ruling, which is coming out in the next few weeks, means that religious considerations are going to be taken into account, families will be consulted, and it does give that space for a Jewish person to be a donor while still adhering to the tenets of the law.
Yeah, and of course, it's just such, as you say, such a sensitive and delicate subject, because of course, as you rightly identify, laws of halakha do state that strictly speaking, we are supposed to be buried as a whole, just for a number of reasons, not least of all, because there's nothing quite so sacred as someone who has passed on. And the truth is that it does give a bit of a moral dilemma. But of course, Justin, it does do a great deal of good to those who can potentially learn to adapt to that way of thinking.
Of course, and Ari Jesner is in a unique position at the Chief Rabbi's office to have been one of the key people in talking to the health authorities and talking to government about this special dispensation, which will enable people to indicate that they are Jewish, that their faith means a lot to them. But that will also be an indication to the health authorities, if someone dies, to speak to their individual rabbi and to get their view on an individual circumstance. So there are many religious rabbis who are minded to enable this where they're able to. And this will give them the opportunity on a case-by-case basis to do that. And hopefully, in turn, we will see an increase in the organ donations within the Orthodox community.
Well, I'm immeasurably proud to say that Ari Jesner will be speaking to us later in this podcast. Let's move on, though, and have a look at some of the other stories making the paper. And there are quite a few stories surrounding, obviously, what's going on with the COVID-19 situation. So, Rich, I think it's best just to get a bit of a roundup of what's going on, really, rather than focusing on one particular.
Yeah, if it's any indication, about 3 months ago, I don't think we had another story that wasn't virus-related in the news section in March into April and May. But as we go along, they are becoming less frequent. But I think we've still got about 27 of them, of which I'll mention a few. We have quite a stark image on the front page as synagogues reopened over the weekend. We've been to Mill Hill United Synagogue to see what social distance davening looks like. Always difficult to describe an image, but it's an aerial shot and you can see the 2 meter rule being adhered to. And I mean, if you look at some of these people, they are quite wrapped up with their, you know, tallits, kippots, masks, tefillin, hats. My wife takes a while to get ready in the morning to go to work, but I imagine this, it must have taken hours for these people to get ready to be COVID-enabled and socially distanced health-wise to attend synagogue and daven without any problem in terms of the virus. So that's quite an interesting stark image. Good to see synagogues up and running. Can't wait until they are now fully functioning in the months to come. We also have a story about the Communal Virus Fund, which is now shut. It's allocated £400,000. This was run by the JLC, Jewish Leadership Council, and Work Avenue. They've helped 500 children, 200 or so households, any sort of small incremental grant up to larger figures, just helping the needy at probably the most crisis-ridden time in the community's recent history. We've got an interesting couple of other stories, which I'll just point out. Someone's got it terribly wrong on page 10. We've got Jewish Care rejecting the Prime Minister for saying that care homes have failed in this crisis. And below, we've got Lord Levy, who's saying that the care homes and the Jewish community have done unbelievably during the pandemic and during the crisis. So like the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial at the moment, somebody's not telling the truth. But I'd like to say I probably agree with Lord Levy on this one. I think our community organisations and our care homes particularly have been over and above in the last few months.
Absolutely. I'd say that sort of it really is a case of just every single walk of life has had to go above and beyond, whether we like it or not. And I believe that care homes have certainly not got enough praise where they are due it. But at the same time, maybe there would be some who would suggest you can't lay the blame on the government at every step of the way. Anyway, let's not get into that, because if we flick to page 28 and let's talk about, let's be honest, one of the best countries, there's an In New Israel online directory.
That's right. We have been working with UJIA and with Andrew Gilbert, a veteran of Jewish news projects, to develop this online directory. And obviously, now more than ever, people will feel a sense of disconnection from Israel. Now, we have Israel on the red section of the government's traffic light system when it comes to travel to Israel. Israel is now experiencing the second spike, which has been worse than the first spike. And it does seem like it's going to be quite a while before we're likely to see any significant travel from the UK to Israel, either business travel or leisure travel. And obviously, this is the moment, or July and August, when so many members of the community are normally laying on the beaches and enjoying the bars and the restaurants and so on. But instead of that, they can go to the paper. They can also go online to see in more detail this online directory, which we have created to provide that connection at this time and beyond to all elements of Israeli society. So there's stuff about restaurants, there's stuff about year groups, there's stuff about food and politics and media and places to go and history and so on. So there's all facets of Israeli society there to be had in the directory. In the paper, we've got 2 pages of the highlights from that directory, but the full directory is online now at a length of about 50 pages. So there's plenty for people to look at, and very proud of this project. And Andrew Gilbert, once again, has left no stone unturned to make sure it's a really great resource for the whole of our community.
Yeah, Andrew has done really well. My favourite one is when you can click on this link and it's immediately 90 degrees out. You can get run over by an electric scooter and then get thrown at by a rude taxi driver. So that's all fun.
I tell you, you haven't lived. I don't know what you're talking about. I think it's wonderful.
Well, I missed it.
I have to tell you, the pair of you have made me utterly, I don't know what the word is, because jealous isn't the right word. It's not like you are there. But and homesick's not the right word either, because obviously I am home, but I can't explain it. You've left me pining. It's not fair. I was supposed to travel to Israel early, like so many, supposed to travel to Israel earlier this year, and it had to be cancelled for obvious reasons. And now I'm looking at all of this. I'm just thinking, oh, send me back. But anyway, as you rightly identify in the paper, that's across page 28 and 29, and then the full directory found online. Thank you very much, both of you. I think that's where we have to leave it for a look at the paper for this week. But thank you to editor Richard Ferrer and news editor Justin Cohen. Don't forget that if you are isolating and you are unable to go and collect your copy of the Jewish News in person, you can find the full paper every Thursday online at jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you both very much.
Shabbat shalom, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, obviously, the subject of COVID-19 has come up time and time again since this podcast was actually started, frankly, quite a few weeks back now. But it's very hard to talk about how it affects the community as a whole. It's even harder to talk about individual stories. And I'm really, really pleased to say that our next guest has been brave enough to share his story with us. I'm very, very sad and sorry for the reason it is, but all the same, Malcolm Green, who lost his late father, Harry, to COVID earlier on in the year, joins us now on the Jewish News Podcast to tell us a little bit about his father and also sort of how the pandemic has affected him and his family. Malcolm, let me start by saying, first and foremost, thank you so much for doing this, because I can't even begin to imagine sort of how unpleasant and uncomfortable it is to have to talk like this about your lovely late father. But I do want people just to get a bit of background, a bit of understanding the situation you find yourself in now and surrounding up to the final weeks, days of your father. Would you please tell us your story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to be honest, the whole thing has been quite surreal, and it is still surreal, and I think that's probably true for everybody. It's really weird, and I spoke about this before, that normally if you lose somebody, a relative, a parent, you go into a kind of system of, obviously you go into grief and mourning, and you know, Judaism has a kind of mechanism for that and a structure for that. And you withdraw from the world outside and you kind of go into your own space and there's shiver and whatever. And the rest of the world, the noise, the joy, the buzz, the life carries on outside. And then it's there for you to rejoin at the appropriate moment. With this, that didn't exist even from that point of view, because the outside world was grieving. If somebody said to me, okay, for a week, you can't watch TV. At the beginning of this crisis, that was not necessarily hardship to not watch TV. Actually, to withdraw from that was probably, you know, a release as much as anything, because the world was grieving actually in the world. And there was outside, there was no joy, there was no happiness, there was just fear. And my dad passed away right at the beginning of the crisis. He passed away March the 23rd, and he'd been in hospital since March the 9th, 10th. So right at the start, he was one of those early people where he was a statistic at first, which, you know, I kind of find quite, I understand the necessity for talking statistics and analyzing statistics, but every one of those statistics on those nightly briefings, they were a father, a mother, a sister, a brother, a husband, a wife, you know, they were lives, actually. And I think there was kind of almost at one point a bit of an insensitivity about that. In terms of how he came to be in the situation he was in, my dad was really independent. He lived alone. And even though he was kind of struggling with health as well, he loved his independence. He loved to be able to go out. He loved to be able to go to Italy once a year and sit on the beach. He loved to be able to meet friends or go for a walk or go shopping. And very early in the situation, probably the middle of February, I had kind of said to him, because I'd been traveling around, I'd said, Dad, there's this thing coming. Stay home. Please stay home. And his kind of answer after that was, well, you know, when Boris tells me to stay home, I'll stay home kind of thing, or whoever. And the more I would tell him to stay home and be safe, the more he would text me and say, hey, guess where I've been? I've been to this tea party there. I've been to Tesco's. I've been to Waitrose. And there was a kind of, it was very, very difficult because if you think about it, so many people in the UK at the time were dismissing what was around the corner. And those of us who were going to other countries, and whether they were other countries in the Far East, I was in Southeast Asia at one point filming there, and I was filming in Denmark, and I was coming back and forward, and there was this insane situation where I found in other countries, they seemed to be taking this thing very, very seriously. And then I would land at Heathrow, and it was kind of, you know, everybody was talking about a mild cold.
And where do you think that that came from? Because there are a lot of people who have said that it was bad leadership that was responsible for us not recognizing just how serious a situation this was. There were quite a few people who have said, and I think a lot of us witness this on a daily basis, the recklessness of society. There are people who know full well we are still, as we speak, in the middle of a pandemic. Okay, that has not gone away. And yet there are still people who insist on not wearing anything such as face coverings or maybe washing their hands as often as they should or maintaining 2 meter distance. You know, all of the rules, whatever it is that people are still not doing that. Where do you think the blame lies? Is it more leadership? Is it more individual responsibility?
I think it's both, actually. I think it's leadership and individual responsibility. I think leadership has to give out messages. Basically, leadership and the thing about messaging from leadership, it has to be, you have to have clarity. You have to have clarity, and you also have to have some decisiveness. And I think part of the issue was that it was like, we need to lock down in 4 days' time. We can open up in 5 days' time. We can do this next week or in 2 weeks. That's confusing to people. And it's not because people are stupid at all, but they just need some clarity because they are trusting. We trust our leaders. We trust our government. And again, let me say, you know, I would hate to be in a position of being in government or being a prime minister or a leader to have to make some of the calls and some of the decisions that had to be made. But at the end of the day, one can compare and say, well, okay, if I was in Denmark on March the 5th, and they were pretty much in lockdown, and every 10 feet I walked, there were hand sanitizers, whether that was the airport, the street, outside restaurants, everywhere. You did not do anything without that. And then I came back to Heathrow, and there was nothing. All that kind of stuff. There's a disconnect there. Now you can say, well, who's got it right? Who's got it wrong? Who's being overcautious? I'm not an overcautious person. You know, for a living, I make, for the most part, documentaries. I love going into jungles where there are, you know, I love going into parts of Senegal where basically it's not safe, or parts of Mexico, things like that. I'm not overly cautious. With this, when you see in other countries what is happening and you see the seriousness which is being taken, you do become cautious, actually.
Just finally, yeah. I think that it is important to someone who has gone through the loss of a relative, a close relative to COVID-19, and bearing in mind that you can take it to a much more personal level than, as you rightly identified towards the beginning of this, those statistics that we were hearing all the time on the daily briefings. Your father was not just one of a number. He was your father. Now, I want you to relay to anyone listening to this or indeed watching it, which is also possible, just what it is that they could be doing and should be doing for themselves, and frankly, for the better of others who may be more vulnerable.
Take it seriously, I think, to everybody. Basically, until we absolutely know that this is either, that we either have a vaccine, which, you know, vaccines are vaccines. You know, there are diseases and illnesses and infections, HIV, we still don't have a vaccine 35 years after, but there is behavioral change there and we have to cope with it. And there is treatment in order to take it seriously. Human life is precious, actually, and not only our own, but other people. What we've seen from this is that we are, you know, what we've seen from this, how we are all together. We are all connected. You know, it's funny, we've been disconnected for 3 months. What happens to you has an effect and an impact on other people. Everybody, we know that now more than ever. The entire world, for a unique first time in history, We are all experiencing the same thing. We're watching, albeit in different languages, the same news programs, the same numbers, the same graphs, the same curves that are either being flattened or not flattened, the same waves, the first, the second, the third, everything. We're all in it together. This is a moment in history that actually, if we do something right, we can take it onto another plane and maybe improve lives for ourselves and for others. But on the other hand, we have realized for the first time we can harm each other. And it's not just whether we kill each other, but there are a lot of people who basically get maybe not necessarily they don't die, but they become ill. And those illnesses, we still do not know the extent of them. You know, we're learning. You know, we have to take this seriously.
Well, I can only say that I desperately hope that people do learn from the situation that your family has found yourself in and from all of us at Jewish News Podcast. Wish you long life. So, so sorry for your loss. And thank you. Thank you so much for being, I don't think it's an exaggeration, brave enough to talk to me and tell us about your story today. Thank you, Malcolm.
Thank you.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, on to a subject of enormous delicacy to some, a subject of much contention. And really, there is, I suppose, a great deal, it can be, of extreme emotions from sadness and joy. When you know what I'm talking about, you'll understand why I say that. When we talk about the world of and the subject of organ donation. Now, obviously, there are changes coming into effect in UK law that will see that we have more of an opt-out system rather than an opt-in. And of course, there have been many discussions surrounding Judaism, heard just now in the paper review, about how that works in association with halakha. The chief executive of the Office of the Chief Rabbi is Ari Jesner. I'm delighted to say that he joins me now. But Ari, there is a particular reason for those who don't know why this subject is more poignant to you on a personal level before we get into the subject of your job.
Hi, Phil. Yes, thank you very much for having me on. That's right. It's very much a personal subject for me because going back to 2002, my younger brother Yoni was killed in a bus bombing and a suicide bombing in Tel Aviv in Israel. And the way he died meant that he was able to be an organ donor. And a number of his organs were donated for transplantation and saved the lives of five individuals, actually. So I have a personal experience of going through the organ donor process. And then when the subject matter came across my desk as chief executive of the Office of the Chief Rabbi, it was of particular interest to me.
Now, did your own family's experience of what you went through with Yoni, your late brother, did it in any way sort of inspire you to want to make sure that this change did happen?
So I think the answer to that is definitely yes. And when I say yes, I'm saying yes to the fact that what was crucially important for me, but in truth to the office and to the chief rabbi, was to see if we could find a way to ensure that the change in the law would be something that could work for the Jewish community and work within Jewish law to allow members of the Jewish community, should they wish to be able to sign up and be organ donors. So in many respects, it was less about the actual law itself and whether we had an opt-in or an opt-out system, and more a case of whichever way the law was going to be, whether it could work for the Jewish community.
Can we explore that a little bit? Because there will be an awful lot of confusion. A lot of people still grapple with the subject of organ donation. Especially, I think actually it's across the spectrum. I'm not going to say it's to do with people who are necessarily more religious than others, because I genuinely believe it's a subject that a lot of Jews struggle to understand how it fits in with Judaism. Where does the Office of the Chief Rabbi stand at the moment in terms of the laws on organ donation, both halakha and also with, I suppose, the British law and the change of British law?
It's a really interesting question and can be quite complex as well. But to boil it down, firstly, I should just say I'm not a rabbi, so it's not for me to be opining on halakha and Jewish law or giving anybody advice on that aspect of it. But from the chief rabbi's perspective, from the perspective of the office, it's our role to ensure that these things work for the Jewish community and that the Jewish community can participate and can contribute in an appropriate way should individuals from the community want to. Jewish law does permit organ donation, and we see Jews donating organs right across the world in all sorts of different jurisdictions and different contexts. And there are different rabbinic opinions on organ donation. Some who would take different views on exactly which organs and particular complexity surrounding the actual definition of death. But that's an area of halachic expertise.
Well, thank you. I appreciate, and I do recognize that I'm asking you sort of more about in the position of your role in the office of the chief rabbi as opposed to in a rabbinic position. How involved have you been yourself in pushing for the changes in recent months? Because I'm assuming there's been a great deal of discussion that's gone on with it. And have you been heavily involved in those discussions and overseeing what sort of changes that we might see as a community moving forward?
Yes, certainly. We've been in discussions for the best part of a couple of years now with NHS Blood and Transplant, which are the part of the NHS responsible for transplantation for organ donation, along with the Human Tissue Authority as well, who have a very important role in regulating this particular area. And it's not so much that in the office we were pushing for a particular law or a change in the law. The law is what it is, and we are where we are. And what we have been focusing on over the last 2 years is to work with colleagues in NHS Blood and Transplant to ensure that the way the new system of opt-out is implemented, it will be a system that will give confidence and enable Jews to comfortably go online and sign up to be organ donors should they wish to. And we've actually achieved that, and credit to the chief rabbi for seeing the opportunity to be able to make this happen, and to NHS Blood and Transplant for working so closely with the Jewish community to take on board our concerns.
And just to reassure people who might be listening who still potentially struggle a little bit with the concept of this opt-in, opt-out change in UK law, there will be exceptions, there will be understanding surrounding faith, won't there? So people will not be, they shouldn't be worried about whether or not they're just going to say, okay, well, when I'm no longer around, then if my family don't say anything beforehand, then suddenly all my organs are going to be donated without my consent. That's not going to be the case, is it?
Correct. I think that's right. And that goes to the heart of some of the misconceptions around a change in the law. Opt-out basically means that if you don't say otherwise, there is deemed consent, or it's assumed that you do want to donate your organs. What it doesn't mean is that should the situation arise and you're able to be a donor, that suddenly someone's going to take your organs away without having had any form of discussion or contacting your family. That's just by way of, I suppose, scaremongering. The truth of the matter is that irrespective of the system in law, the NHS will always have conversations with the family and will not do anything against the wishes of the family and will ensure that families are consulted as part of that process. What we have introduced as part of the organ donor system is that when you register to be a donor, you tick a box that says faith is important to you and that you'd like your family to be consulted as part of that process. And that goes along with your faith authority or your religious authority, your advisor in a Jewish community context, that would be a rabbi. And the NHS have a very clear statement there where they commit to engaging with families and engaging with religious authorities to ensure that all the religious aspects of possible donation can be taken account of, and no decision as to donation will be made until the family and the religious authority are satisfied. So in many respects, and I sort of hesitate to use this terminology because it's not language that the NHS would use, but we've effectively created a system of conditional donation where we're saying, yes, as a matter of principle, I'd like to be a donor. I think that's important, but it's conditional upon it being compliant with Jewish law. And to answer that question, that will be determined by the facts and the particular circumstances and the particular case of every individual deceased person who is a potential donor.
Well, in that case, I would suggest that if anyone does want more information on this very subject, that they look at organdonation.nhs.uk. In the meantime, Ari Jesner, Chief Executive of the Office of the Chief Rabbi, thank you very much indeed for speaking to me on the Jewish News Podcast. This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, in and amongst all the news this week, there was one particular headline that certainly got my attention, and if I'm perfectly honest, shocked and saddened me a little bit. Because, well, actually not a little bit, quite a lot really, because it's someone who I've long admired, and I have to declare, being a Reform Jew myself, is someone who I class as my senior rabbi. So there we go, senior Reform Rabbi Laura Jenna Klausner to leave role. Yes, I'm sorry if you haven't heard the news, but there it is. However, it's not all bad because it means I get another opportunity to speak to Rabbi Laura, and I am delighted to say that she joins me now. Rabbi Laura, how could you?
Well, I think it's sort of normal life, isn't it? 10 years, nearly 10 years, 9 years. And you think, one of the things that happened during lockdown, I don't know why I'm talking about in the past tense, seeing with continuing, is it did make me, as with many people, reassess my life, what I want to do, what I want to do next. And it had been in the back of my mind. And then during lockdown, I thought, actually, I need less. I want to do less in public and turn inwards. The other thing that's happened is what is happening online to people, what they're experiencing has become more and more, for me, urgent to look at properly in order to be able to impact upon it for the future. So that has sort of shifted what I've done. And also, I think we've accomplished a lot in the Reform movement in the last 9 years.
Well, let's talk a bit about that, because I want to go back right to the beginning where you say almost 10 years ago when you started the role. Just to clarify, am I right in thinking that there wasn't really a senior rabbi for Reform Judaism before you?
That's correct. There was a chief executive, a head of movement, and I started as what we called movement rabbi, but people didn't really understand what that was, which is fair. And then we decided, you know, in order to express the role, we needed a title that people understood. And actually, it was my rabbinic colleagues, because there wasn't a cantor then, and now there are four, which is brilliant, who said, because you're very non-hierarchical, we think that for you, you should be the senior rabbi, which is a really, really, probably one of the loveliest compliments in my life, because when it comes from your peers, it means a hell of a lot. It really does.
And I would suggest, speaking personally and having known you for quite a while, that I believe they did make quite a good choice, if you don't mind me saying.
Thank you. Well, you are very biased. But yes, I think I am slightly, but it's with good reason. I tried to be a voice for my colleagues and to be their mouthpiece, as well as their, I mean, loads of my colleagues, thank God, are also wonderful, you know, super articulate in and of themselves. So I think the senior rabbi title belongs to the movement as a whole, to Reform Judaism, and not to me as an individual.
Goodness only knows how long Reform Judaism has been around per se, but it somehow feels as though during your tenure, it's sort of put it a bit more on the map. Would that be fair?
I hope so. I think both in the Reform communities for ourselves, in the Jewish community as a whole, I think pretty much definitely, in a way of collegiality together. And I think what's been wonderful in the Jewish community is there have been certain issues, some difficult and some more galvanized us, that have just cut across communal lines. So we've worked together on issues of anti-Semitism, on refugees, on poverty, and people have taken off their particular kippah and just got in there to work together, which I've really adored, because I think I don't really feel that I'm a Reform Jew. I am a Jew, and I've said this all the way through, whose type of Judaism is this type. But Reform Judaism is not a limiting thing. It's not a limiting adjective, let's say. But I think also from the point of view of the national scene and international, Reform Judaism has become people who are asked to give opinion upon, you know, major issues that affect the country, which is great. So I do think that there's no going back from that.
Now, when are you off and what are you going to be doing moving forward?
So I'm off from this particular role on the 1st of October, and I'm going to be doing primarily two things. One is starting a PhD in digital, and it's looking at how young adults, Jewish young adults, who are involved in online Jewish spaces, how it affects their participation and how they see in-person communities. So we will have again at one point, please God, in-person communities. I suppose the question is, who's going to be in our shuls in the future?
Well, I mean, there is a question that has been plaguing everybody, let's be honest.
That's true. That's everyone. But the question before COVID, and it's obviously changed nuance now, is if young adults are so involved in online communities, what's the meaning of online communities for them? And how will this impact on their participation in Jewish in-person communities? That's one area. And the other thing I'm going to do is go back to what I've done for years and years, which is training, leadership training, resilience training. In my personal capacity, I wrote a book called this, especially during COVID, about resilience during crisis, and not in my role, but as in my personal life. So I really missed that direct training. And I did leadership training in Israel for 18-year-olds and also Palestinians and Israelis. So it's going back to that, and I'm going to start a business in consulting, training, mediation, and I'm also looking at going into certain parts of the law around online, because the thing that really is worries me is what is called a terrible title, the Internet of Harm, where people are involved in and encouraged to harm themselves. It's kind of idealized in some kind of way. And I didn't want to spend time in a PhD doing that, because I would have to spend however many years feeling terrible, and I wanted to do more joyous things. But impacting on social media companies, how they are, you know, what we've seen this week is so fascinating with advertising companies and Facebook, how Twitter's reacted to things, how it has a very different genre. And I think these are the campaigns that I really want to be involved in the future, because they affect us globally so much.
Just finally, who is going to, do we know yet, succeed you, if anybody? Is the role of Senior Rabbi for Reform Judaism going to carry on?
I think as a kadosh holy thing, the person who leaves a role steps back and does not impact on what happens in the future, because, you know, it is part of certainly how I see power, that it doesn't belong to me in any way. So I am stepping right away from that one. And I think what is the thing that I know is that my colleagues at Reform Judaism are not panicking, which is brilliant, and I'm not saying we need to get out an advert tomorrow, which has happened in the past, and they are saying we're going to use this time to reassess, which is wonderful. So I think well done them, that they're not sticking a job advert out next week, and that they'll look at what is the need, what do we want our Judaism to look like, how will this be in our communities, and therefore what do we need this role to be, is the order of things, rather than we must get a new person. It's an idea, which is great.
Well,
exciting.
Great and exciting is exactly what the last 9 to 10 years have been with you at the helm of Reform Judaism. Rabbi Laura Jana Klausner, thank you so much for not
very
just
much
speaking to me, but thank you for everything you've done for Reform Judaism as well. And Judaism as a whole.
Thank you. Thank you, Phil. Very, very much. Thank you. Can I just say one thing? Advert.
Oh.
One advert. I love the Jewish news. Love.
We'll allow that one.
I'm allowed that one.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, a personal message written on a German banknote 75 years ago to a Holocaust survivor has set in motion an extraordinary search for the family of its author, an American soldier who helped liberate Lily Ebert from a death march. I'm delighted to say that we can now speak to Lily's great-grandson, Dov Foreman. He joins me now. Dov, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast. And let's start off with, where was this discovered?
So obviously it's been lockdown for the past few months. And during lockdown, I was just thinking that I should really start learning my great-grandma's story a lot more. And so when we were allowed to bubble, I went round there and I started speaking to her that I want to document her story and start sharing it online and start sharing it on Twitter with the world. And so she was taking me through some things, and we stumbled across this banknote And she said to me, oh, this is the banknote that a liberator gave to me. And it was the first person that was kind to me. And it really touched my heart because you don't often see the kindness of the liberators shared online. And what's really sad is that they also had to live with the horrors of what they saw their whole life. And I know that I now know, after speaking to the family of the soldier, that he never spoke about his experiences, and he saw some terrible things at Buchenwald concentration camp, which is the first concentration camp he liberated. So I thought it was really important to share the banknote with the world and the kindness of the liberators.
So you've almost given the game away. So I suspect now that what you're telling us is that you have been in contact with the family of the person who wrote that note to your great-grandmother. However, let's look a little more at the banknote first of all. The message on it, quite poignant. For those who don't know, what does it say? What was the message to your great-grandmother?
The message on one side was, it's 10 words, the start to a new life. And on the other side, good luck and happiness.
Isn't that amazing? Seriously. That's so, and like you say, that was your great-grandmother's first indication at kindness, despite everything that she went through.
Yeah. And on the bottom, actually, it's important to note that it says he was assistant to Chaplain Schechter, who was the first chaplain / rabbi to also liberate a camp. And that is eventually how Twitter helped us find the soldier. But as you said, we'll speak about that later.
Well, let's talk a bit about that search, because how did the search come about? How did it work? What did you have to do? And tell us a little bit about tracking down the author of that particular note.
So as any maybe 16-year-old would do nowadays, I took to Twitter and posted the note on Twitter. And I didn't really expect so much attraction. I thought maybe some smaller accounts will retweet it and people that are interested in the Holocaust will look at it. But I woke up the next day and I saw that Auschwitz Memorial account, who have 1 million followers on Twitter, retweeted it. And from there, the likes and shares just went up, and it's now been seen by 1,200,000 people. Which is
So let's clarify. You have gone viral, or rather your great-grandmother's banknote has gone viral.
Yeah, which is just incredible. I never thought that it would turn out like this, and it just shows how we can use social media in a positive way. And it's really amazing how much love on the tweet people have been sending my great-grandma. And another thing which I found was really I'm scared to say on the tweet we got a bit of anti-Semitism, and I was going to say it's all right that we only got 3 tweets, but obviously...
Do you know what? Allow me to save you here, because I know what you are getting at. Considering how many people saw that, and considering how bad it could have been, I think we should count our lucky stars that it was only 3 individuals who, frankly, are not worth another second. So let's not dwell on those losers. Let's move on. And let's, in particular, just between you and me, how did you do for followers out of it? Did you get a few more Twitter followers?
I think I gained 200.
Excellent work. So, well done. Now, let's talk about the moment that you got in contact with the family of the author of this message to your great-grandmother. What was that moment like?
I think, firstly, it's important to note that they didn't reach out to us. We didn't reach out to them. It was first to find the soldier. Someone random on Twitter just sent me the name and said that this must be the soldier. I did some investigation into that, looked at the articles online, and found out that yes, it must be him. And now we know it's him. And my grandma actually got in contact with the family. Unfortunately, the soldier died 7 years ago and his wife died in March, but we were able to get hold of his daughter-in-law, Arlene Schulman. And so I think at the beginning they were kind of shocked because, as I said, he never spoke about his story and they didn't know about this. But eventually we got talking to them, and then they were telling us about what he experienced and what we were telling them about what my great-grandma experienced. And it was just really special because this family and the soldier had played such a big part in my great-grandma's liberation. And so it's really special that now 75 years on, and actually it's today, 76 years ago, my great-grandma was deported to Auschwitz. It's incredible that 75 years on, we're able to contact the family.
It is absolutely incredible. And do you know what? This is considering how sad the start of this story is based on what your great-grandmother went through during the Holocaust, the fact that 75 years later, something, or 76 years later now, as you identify, something nice has actually come out of it, it does seem pretty incredible and just goes to show that the proverbial phoenix can rise once in a while. I'm thinking that if people want to see this particular banknote, there are pictures of it online. So either you can go to jewishnews.co.uk and you'll find it there, or on Twitter. Let's try and up that following a bit more. You could also go to @DovForman as well. Yeah. Just finally, you said that you wanted to use lockdown after the social bubbles were allowed to find out more about your great-grandmother's experience. What did you learn that you didn't know before?
So I think a lot of the things I've been trying to get from her are for her to show me tangible things that I can go out, and when she's not able to talk anymore, that I can go out and show these things to people. And I think another thing that I've been doing is taking videos of her explaining certain parts of the story, like the death march or the transportation to Auschwitz, and taking short 2-minute videos and sharing those, because they're really accessible and easy for people to watch. And I think something I've learned is also just the kindness that she received after the war, and just again the horrors that went on in Auschwitz and during the period.
Well, bravo to you for using this time very wisely to learn from all of our history, and especially bravo to your great-grandmother, who obviously her story is what's facilitated not only what you've learnt, but also this discussion between you and me. Dov Forman, yeah, Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us, and much regards to your great-grandmother as well, Lily Ebert.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Time now for some wise and comedic words from, well, comedian Ashley Blaker.
Hello, friends. Ashley Blaker here, back on the Jewish News Podcast. And it's another week of excitement. 2 weeks ago, it was Liverpool had just won the league. Then we were excited about shuls reopening. But now, joy upon joys, restaurants have reopened. Yes, I know you can get takeaways, but I want to sit in a restaurant. And I must be honest, nothing against my wife's cooking, but I've really missed eating out. In fact, I should say it's a genuine ambition of mine to one day write a history of the UK's kosher restaurants entitled Our Credit Card Machine Isn't Working Yet. It's either going to be called that or The Fires Next Week. I joke, but it is one of the mysteries of the modern world, how there have been more fires in kosher restaurants on the Golders Green Road than they've ever had in Coronation Street. If this was a soap opera, people would call it far-fetched. I wouldn't be surprised to find out there'd been a kosher restaurant on the roof of Notre Dame. I saw all that debate last year about what caused the bushfires in Australia. Some people blamed arson, some people blamed global warming. You know what I thought? Kosher restaurants. The trouble is, of course, there are hardly any kosher restaurants outside Jewish neighbourhoods. We're much worse off than Muslims, who've got restaurants everywhere, including over 100 halal branches of Chicken Cottage. On the other hand, we're much better off than Muslims, because there are no kosher branches of Chicken Cottage. And praise be to the Almighty that we're both spared the evil that is Domino's Pizza. Keeping kosher isn't easy when you leave North London. Last year, I was performing in Bradford with my friend Imran. And while he was going to get local halal takeaways, I had to resort to photosynthesizing by staring at the sun to take in nutrients. I did order a delivery one night from Uber Eats, but they had to bring the food up from Golders Green. By the time it got up the M1, not only was it freezing cold, we'd already moved on to Hull. But in the recent lockdown, I found myself missing kosher restaurants more than ever. And in fact, the kosher restaurant that I've missed the most, oddly, is one that hadn't been open for over 10 years. And that is Blooms. Now, to anyone who, for some bizarre reason, doesn't know what Blooms is, I can only assume you are under the age of 15 or not British and have just stumbled upon this podcast. Blooms was a kosher restaurant in London that closed in 2010. Now, actually, I say a restaurant. There are three of them. There was one in the old Jewish East End. There was one in Golders Green. And then briefly, there was one in Edgware, run by one of the blokes off Gogglebox. Now, if I ever catch Gogglebox, I immediately get a Pavlovian desire for chicken soup and lakshin. But it was the oddest restaurant that has ever existed, Blooms, because the food was utterly horrible. It was. But you went for the experience of the rudest waiters in the world. There was a fat Greek man with a handlebar moustache called Leon. And then there was a very thin-faced Indian waiter who apparently now works in a Tesco Express in Barnet. And the reason they were so aggressive was because they had an ordering system completely unique in the history of restaurants. Basically, what happened was the waiter bought the food himself from the restaurant and then sold it on to the customer at a profit. It was kind of like the Amazon marketplace of restaurants. So because they were financially motivated, they'd be hurrying you along, bringing all your food at once, refusing to send any food back. A hair in your food, you'd have had to have found a decapitated head that the hair came from before these waiters would have taken a sandwich off the bill. But the thing I love with this idea of selling the food to the waiter is the most Jewish idea ever. The owner must have been sat at home and thought, I found a loophole. I can't believe it. I found a loophole. If we make the waiters all private contractors, then I can save money on national insurance. But it can't have worked. Not only did Blooms eventually close down, but in the entire history of mankind, there have been billions and billions of restaurants, and no one else has ever done this, which suggests that the idea was utter rubbish. Now, Rishi Sunak is offering 50% off your bill in a restaurant next month up to the value of £10. And I just wish Blooms was still around to see the look on Leon or the very thin-faced Indian waiter's face when somebody said they were paying with a voucher. I don't care if the Chancellor of Exchequer had signed it off himself. There is no way that would have worked in Blooms. And it's such a shame it's closed that we can't get to see that scene. Oh, well, I'm off to try not to think about food because it's a fast day today. But hopefully I'll see you in a restaurant somewhere in North London very soon. Bye.
Thank you very much to comedian Ashley Blaker there for not only his wise and humorous words, but for now making me, and I'm sure you, absolutely ravenous. Anyway, I'll go for a sandwich in a moment. I think all that's left for me to do is to say thank you very much to all of the guests who have appeared on this edition of the Jewish News podcast, to Malcolm Green, Rabbi Laura Jenna Klausner, Dov Foreman, and Ari Jesner, and of course, comedian Ashley Blaker, as well as our pay-per-view team, Richard Ferrer and Justin Cohen. And we must say thank you to Justin Cohen, who produced this episode as well. And must not forget to say thank you to you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. The Jewish News Podcast is in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group through its partners. GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. And for more information, you can always go to gpg.org. I'm Phil Dave. Do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.